you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
Political Analysis, aired at this time every Tuesday right here on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Sandy Leon Vest. I'm also the editor and publisher of Solar Times, an independent news publication that looks at energy from a progressive and a humanitarian perspective. Solar Times can be viewed online at solartimes.org. Yesterday, March 26th, the United Steelworkers, together with Mondragon Co-ops in the Ohio Employee Ownership Center, announced they would form a new model for a union co-op that will work to combine principles of worker ownership and labor solidarity. This development, according to at least one and maybe most and maybe both of tonight's guests, represents a major and positive historic advance in community wealth building and could potentially forge the building blocks of a new economy. My guests tonight are author, educator, and journalist Gar Alperovitz and entrepreneur, author, and organic farmer Brian Welch. Brian Welch is also publisher of the highly successful Mother Earth News, among other publications, and one of the nation's leading thinkers on what some have dubbed the new capitalism. Gar Alperovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. Among his most recent books are America Beyond Capitalism and Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and Why We Should Take It Back. As conveyed by the title of at least one of his books, Gar Alperovitz believes that the U.S. needs to move beyond capitalism if we are to pave the path to a vibrant democracy, a sustainable economy, and a future worth living. He envisions an economy that is capable of fulfilling human needs and allows participants to control both their work and day-to-day lives in a hands-on fashion. Brian Welch has a slightly different take, favoring a new kind of capitalism. Brian's vision of a better, more sustainable world proposes a capitalism that distributes value according to the durability, provenance, and sustainability of products by paying attention to every consequence of a company's operation. Both men are with us tonight on Political Analysis to share their ideas and hopefully find much they can agree on in the course of their conversation. Brian Welch, Gar Alperovitz, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be with you.
You're welcome. I hope I described you both accurately.
Oh, I thought you did a little better than reality on my part.
Close enough.
Why, thank you. So it occurred to me while researching the two of you, your work, your books, that I probably didn't need to work as hard as I was working, that the conversation in this case is the show. So in light of that sort of light bulb moment, I think what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is just kind of hand over tonight's show to the two of you. So let's, is that all right?
Sure.
Good. So let's just start with you, Brian Welch. What does the term new capitalism mean? And what exactly is wrong with capitalism in its present iteration?
Well, the implication is that capitalism can adapt to new sets of circumstances. And, you know, I think Gar and I probably agree on some of the general shapes and forms that the new economy should take. We can call it capitalism or not, but in my opinion, some free enterprise is going to be one of the ingredients. So
you know, capitalism isn't very old. Industrial society is 200 or 300 years old, really. Capitalism somewhat less than that. And it has this sort of adolescent idea about itself, that it can just go about doing things instinctively, according to, you know, one or two simple rules, never having to learn anything new, and then everything's just going to be hunky-dory, just leaving it all up to this, you know, supposed invisible hand of the market or whatever. You know, nothing, no institution is static that way for centuries and centuries. And we look at a situation in which the human population is testing the limits of the habitat and technology is advancing at an unprecedented pace and creating a lot of new power for humanity. You're setting up a situation in which an institution as central to human endeavor as capitalism is going to have to adapt to a whole new set of circumstances. In my opinion, the new capitalism is something that takes account of the effects of creating products and services at every part of the production cycle, so that, you know, when you extract raw materials, you need to do that in a conscientious way, and when you assemble them in your basic ingredients, that needs to be done in a conscientious way that's helpful to the environment and the people involved. And then as you pull that together into a final product and distribute it to consumers, again, it needs to all be done in a way that's that conscientiously cares for the human beings involved and the environment. And in fact, I think consumers have all the power they need already in this world to direct that change. We just need to teach consumers and teach ourselves to make wise, fully informed decisions about the companies with whom we do business, and to give a big advantage to companies who are doing business in a conscientious way.
Gar Alperovitz, extracting in a conscientious way. But, I mean, can corporations do that? Will they do that?
Well, I am in line with Brian as far as we can go in that direction.
want to hear the however.
No, I genuinely mean it. I think there is a whole movement in the, you know, the business alliance for local economic and local living economies, and there are a growing number of businessmen who take very seriously and very thoughtfully exactly what Brian's saying, and I think that's a growing movement. I don't think, however, what we know about, you know, the way corporate capitalism works, or state socialism for that matter, I'm not a proponent of either. Mm-hmm. The way corporate capitalism, the large entities in the economy, have control over marketing, have powerful control over marketing, which can be eaten away at certain parts by the kind of good tactics and good strategies of conscientious smaller scale businesses. But by and large, they dominate finance and they dominate advertising, and they must grow. That is to say, so long as you finance through the stock market, and quarterly returns are almost everything, their primary impetus is growth and exploitation of resources, generating externalities, that is, environmentally, whatever costs money, they try to save, which means often deterioration of the environment, the CO2 production, et cetera, resource use against the limits of growth we now face. And when you come to the big guys, they also, so that's one piece of it, the dynamic to grow and the necessity to grow and the market control through advertising and through finance is very, very powerful, as we know when we look at the industry by industry. The domination is three or four big corporations, which has been pretty well studied. So you can do a lot on the small scale, and you can do a lot in communities, but you run into a problem here. The other big question I've been, you know, really struggling with in trying to think through, you know, the way I put it is, if you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want? And I think that is not a kind of rhetorical question. It really is, how do we define the outlines in an intelligent democratic form of a system that doesn't have to confine itself to the traditional outlines. The other big problem, I've worked a lot in the Midwest with you know, cities in Cleveland, for instance, in Youngstown, Ohio, Detroit, and what you see there is, you know, it pays the big companies, whether it be steel companies or auto companies, two are obvious ones, to move into certain cities, extracting very large contributions from the taxpayer, often of the level of $150 to $200 per $200,000 per job. as an incentive, and often moving on. And from an environmental point of view, quite apart from the fiscal point of view, which is very costly, and from the point of view of the capital costs, just think about it. You've got houses, you've got roads, you've got schools, you've got hospitals, you've got city facilities for the population that lives in the old city. And then the corporation moves on, and those people have to leave if there are no new jobs. That capital deteriorates, and you have to build it someplace else. Well, there are more than two problems. First, there's a human misery question when that happens. But also, there are capital costs that are extreme, and even more important, carbon costs. So there are very large questions that are raised by the big corporations. As I say, I think we can do a great deal, and I'm delighted to see it at the lower level, smaller scale, but I'm worried about the big scale.
And may I interrupt you just for a minute? Also, that capitalism, or excuse me, that the capital moves easily across borders,
yes,
whereas people can't do that so easily.
That's another piece of the puzzle. And just to round out some of the dimensions of the things we're talking about, because I suspect Brian and I agree on another piece. You mentioned at the very outset the co-ops and the attempt now by the United States, the United Steelworkers, to work with other groups to establish co-ops with unions within them. And we've had a good deal of experience working with worker co-ops, which have many advantages, including being democratic and reallocating capital in a more equitable way, and building some kind of a culture of community. Most important, worker-owned co-ops and worker-owned companies. There are actually 10 million people work in worker-owned companies in America, 5 million more than work in the union companies. What they don't do is move, because people live where they live,
mm-hmm,
and they are anchored, and they anchor capital, and they save capital, and they save carbon costs. So we're very much as far as you can go with small business and local co-ops and worker-owned companies. At least the work we've done, we think that's an important emphasis. But when you get to the big guys, then you have a real set of questions that people haven't, I don't think, been willing to face.
And so, Brian Welsh, there are those who would, and who do, in fact, argue that we don't actually even have capitalism right now in this country, that at least in its current iteration, we have something more like cronyism, that's sort of morphing into, for lack of a better term, corporate fascism. How do you see addressing this? What's your vision?
There's always a puritanical view of these things. We don't have capitalism in the same sense that very few of us have purely romantic marriages. There isn't any pure capitalism in the world. There's nothing. We don't really have pure water either, or pure air, or a lot of other things in their purest form. And there's always, there should be virulent and vibrant criticism of the current systems and the current institutions, and that should be ongoing and strident and you should be able to hear it from all the corners of the globe. I think the fundamental question for me is, by the way, I do agree with Gar most certainly that any form of ownership of assets should be legal and should be free to compete with all the other forms of ownership. And so in the places like, for instance, in Spain, where some of the big co-ops are dominant in several business categories, I have to applaud that, because they do a tremendous job in business, and they're very good to the workers because the workers own them. And there's this, an almost universal good to be a great example of universal good to be seen there. But my point would be, what I don't want to do is limit the ability of free enterprise, that limit the ability of individuals to exert force in the marketplace, either as entrepreneurs or as consumers. I mean, 6 out of 10 of the richest people in the world at this moment were born either poor or middle class. They weren't wealthy at all when they were born. The world has given those 6 people the opportunity of building new companies. 7 out of the 10 most valuable companies in North America were built within our generation, since the time I was getting out of college. And so that kind of dynamism in the system gives a lot of power to consumers. And I think at the end of the day, the conscientiousness of companies should become one part of the whole quality paradigm. And we need to leave consumers the market free enough so that consumers can wield power in the marketplace, as they're beginning to do. I mean, think of a time, there was never a time in the history of capitalism when the world's most valuable company, which is presently Apple Computer, would be changing its fundamental human resource practices based on what a couple of, you know, guys with iPhone cameras concocted standing at the gates of a factory somewhere in eastern China. I mean, the impact of the digital media and of consumer demand on even the biggest companies in the world is very impressive. And I think it's only going to get more impressive. I want to make sure the markets, I mean, I at least encourage everyone to favor the kind of open markets that give that power to the consumer, rather than giving it to any sort of, you know, big institution, big government, big corporations or whatever. I just prefer that the big corporations not have the opportunity of limiting competition, and that government not get involved with limiting competition, and I'd prefer to the extent possible to leave the power in the hands of the consumers.
Gar Alperovitz, in a corporate-owned economy, I mean, for lack of a better term,
right,
where, I mean, thanks to groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, corporations are now teaming up with legislators to write laws that favor corporate control. So how can worker-owned co-ops survive this kind of environment? And if you want to respond to what Brian Welsh just said, please.
It's a good conversation. So let me kind of at least speak to some of the points that Brian raised.
What
are opened up are really fundamental issues of systemic design, for lack of a better word. For one, consumers in the marketplace. As you know that the current system is producing wealth and income distribution in horrendously inequitable ways, so that the votes of people at the very top in the marketplace, as they go to purchase, are heavily weighted in favor of the top groups rather than the mass society. So that what we call the market is a very odd thing in a highly inequitable society.
Although it is, I think, a more equitable society than it was 100 years ago.
Oh, no. No. Not necessarily so. The 19th century, end of the 19th century, was a much more equitable society. That was based, until, you know, the latter years of the 19th century, on something like what I think you're talking about, because the mass of the society, the vast majority, were small businessmen, farmers. And that was the free market economy, and that's a different animal from what we now have.
Yeah, sure, I totally agree. Are we talking about global or North American now, Carr?
Well, I was trying to address the United States just for the moment. We could go to global second if we could, but I wanted to respond just
sure.
In terms of your questions you were raising about
Please.
The United States.
Yeah.
Let me give you a number that I double-checked several times because I didn't believe it when I first saw it. And this tells you about power in the marketplace and power in politics. The question you were raising, Sandy, the issue of can ALEC and others buy legislators to tilt the market in a different way. The top 400 people, individuals, own more wealth than the bottom 180 million Americans, the bottom 60%. It is one of the most concentrated corporate capitalist systems that has ever existed, and we aren't quite aware of how concentrated it is, which has implications for politics, it has implications for the dominating the control of corporate structures or the finance system. If it were a free market system, and as I say, the 19th century has many flaws, but indeed it approached it much more closely than what we now live with, well, that would be a different story. But I don't think you can wind the clock back. I wish you could. Attempts to do antitrust, which I support, have largely failed in recent years because of the power of these large institutions. I live in Washington. I used to run House and Senate staff at one point in my life. The place is swarming with, you know, more lobbyists with big checkbooks in their hands running up to Capitol Hill and not only providing money and influence, but teaching these young congressmen and young staff people what they ought to be thinking about it. You mentioned ALEC, which is financed by a conservative organization that produces draft legislation that they just hand off and gets introduced. If it were the free market system, and if you could sustain it genuinely, that would be not problematic for many. That would have some other problems about whether you control the business cycle and so forth, but that's a very different animal. So my question and my concern, and I have to say it's been a genuine concern. I've been asking myself, because I certainly don't believe in these state socialist systems, so I've been genuinely asking myself now for the last 20 years and working with models and experiments on the ground in various different parts of the country. You mentioned Spain, and the Basque country is very interesting. How do we design a system that is genuinely democratic, equitable, inventive, and creative, and indeed can manage itself in the world in which we need to limit growth for ecological reasons? And that's a very demanding question, which I think goes beyond some of the things we've so far discussed in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to take a run at that, Gar?
I wish you would, Brian Welsh.
Oh. Well, maybe I can describe, I certainly can't describe the finished product, but maybe I can describe what I would consider some of the ingredients in the finished product.
Please.
One, I think all political giving should be individual and transparent. So no money should be involved in our democratic government that isn't donated by individuals and perfectly transparent. We need to know where every dollar comes from and every dollar goes to.
May
please.
Would you mind me asking? I mean, I'll interrupt or not interrupt.
No, go ahead and interject.
I don't mind. Everyone would agree with the word should. The question becomes, given the power of the large, very, very wealthy, and the large corporation, is that possible?
That's a good question.
Sure.
That, the answer I say is, at this point, without major change in the institutions, we can get into, you asked, Sandy, how would we get from here to there? We can talk about that. It's the other thing I worry about a lot and think about.
Yeah.
But it should won't do it for me.
I'll tell you what, why don't we get through my ingredients?
Sure.
We can tackle them one at a time, because I'm going to lose track. Unfortunately, I don't have the attention span to name my ingredients in pieces, I don't think. I'm afraid I'll lose track.
Fair enough.
So, a transparent political system. Absolute enforcement of employment regulations as they pertain to immigration law. And that is enforcement against employers. So that we have to actually come to grips with what it would cost us to put a roof on the house if there were no undocumented workers in the United States putting roofs on houses, which I think is both a legal form of slavery and a release valve for rapid population growth in other parts of the world where it's doing a lot of environmental damage. And I think that there should be no limit on corporate liability of any kind. If there were no limit on corporate liability, there would be BP would have been destroyed by the recent Gulf oil spill. It's the legal limits we've placed on corporate liability in cases like that that allows a company like that to continue operating after making a colossal mess of that kind. I think the market, that our tort law would have taken care of BP once and for all. And in the future, big oil companies wouldn't behave with the same sort of disregard. Their priorities would be shifted. So those are three of the ingredients, and as I say, nothing like a complete picture, but three ingredients that would go a long way toward changing the way that big institutions operate and conceivably limiting the size of those big institutions by equalizing the playing field for their smaller competition.
But Brian Welsh and then Gar Alperovitz, not to sound like a broken record here, but how do we get the kind of legislation passed that would ensure that, Brian Welsh? Let me just finish my question. How do we get that kind of legislation passed, much less implemented, much less enforced in a corporate-dominated political economy, if you will?
How do we get 25-year-olds to vote? I'm answering a question with a question. But between the ages of 65 and 85, something close to 70% of eligible voters vote in the United States. Between the ages of 18 and 35, that number is closer to 20%. So our government is elected by retired people with a very limited set of concerns and a very limited time horizon for those concerns. And I think to a very great degree, the aspects of our legislative bodies that you're describing that are inarguably broken, inefficient, badly tuned to the needs of our society, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the people are not electing those legislative bodies. A very small group of Americans is electing our government, and I frankly do not understand why. That's a mystery I personally haven't been able to solve, but it does a lot of damage to the fabric of our society.
And Gar Alperovitz, before the break, just quickly, how would you respond to that question?
Well, I think the numbers are roughly right, but I'd like to, we may well have more time to talk about it, but historically, in the United States, the blocking force against corporate power that allowed a more inspiring agenda politically that brings young people in all the countries, was a strong labor movement for better or worse. And it was able to, I worked for Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day, and to elect liberal and progressive congressmen, even when they disagreed with labor, you needed both environmentalists and labor to block the corporations or hold them back. That's over. The labor unions were at 35% of the labor force. They're now at 11, in the private sector less than 7, and declining. We're in a whole new era when the blocking force to corporate power is over and or declining, and we're going to have to go in a new direction. We'll talk about that after the break. But that means politics is not inspiring for the young.
No, we might even have to bring the term radical into the conversation. And I mean, there are so many people right now who, when you talk about we'll need different kinds of institutions because so much of what's going on is now essentially institutionalized, and we're really talking about a radical sort of rethinking and reforming of basic institutions.
Yes, have we got time to talk, or are we going to the break?
What we're going to do is we're going to take a short break right now.
Okay.
And then we'll come back and we'll pick it up right there. Okay. With how do we essentially tear down what's the current institutionalized system and rebuild another one? And I know Brian Welch will have something to say about that as well. So we'll take a short break and we'll be back with tonight's guests, Brian Welch and Gar Alperovitz, to continue this already fascinating discussion on how to move forward toward a sustainable and livable future in these challenging times. I'm Sandy Leon Best. You're listening to Political Analysis. And welcome back to Political Analysis. I'm Sandy Leon Best, and I have on the phone with me this evening author, educator, and journalist Gar Alperovitz, and entrepreneur, author, organic farmer, and editor of Mother Earth News, Brian Welch. Gar Alperovitz is also a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. So, Brian Welch, I mentioned the term just before we went to break, the term radical, and I want you to know before everybody starts cringing that I use the term in the literal sense, the Latin sense, meaning, you know, going to the root of the problem. And I actually am kind of a fan of redefining the word radical, so or defining it in its original sense so that it isn't a dirty word. But talk about what we were talking about just before we went to break in the sense of, do we need to start over?
Wow, start over. You mean strip the institutions down to the ground, that kind of radical thinking?
Well, something close to that. Certainly some of the institutions that we have that are not just dysfunctional, but essentially non-functional, at least in the sense of the people getting what they need out of it.
Well, you know, not. I tend not to think of things in those terms, Sandy. What I will say is, what we don't want to do is set up a situation in which the warlords, the thugs, those with the greatest physical force to wield in society take over, which we see happen all around the world when, you know, I mean, a lot of the things going on in the Arab Spring were widely lauded by progressives in the Western world. But the unfortunate consequence of some of that activity was to open up opportunities for fundamentalist thugs in those countries and to perhaps take those countries back to an era in which bullies basically ruled those societies. And the history of humanity has been a history mostly of societies run by, you know, autocrats of one brand or another. And so I think we have something good in democracy to defend, and I'm cautious about encouraging anyone to strip our institutions down to the ground, because some of those institutions are very important for protecting the very rights that will allow us to implement the kind of change that we're talking about on this show this evening.
Well, then let's just shift that a little bit to not so much maybe stripping our institutions down as perhaps what is the importance, Gar Alperovitz, of working on implementing, creating an alternative paradigm, creating alternative models, perhaps alongside of the old institutions, at least for the time being.
Well, that's how I think about it too. I mean, our language is not terrific in the way we use words in general. I'm not talking about this conversation. So, for instance, the term reform, which is the common term for political policy changes, assumes that the existing major institutions like the large corporation exist. And then you pass legislation to control it either through antitrust or regulations on the environment or the three points that Brian made, policies. But you don't change the fundamental power structure of the institutions, usually institutions that involve the ownership of wealth and productive wealth. As I said, in our society, 400 people own more productive wealth than the bottom 180 million. So the second one is revolution, which I think Brian was talking about, which is you do change the institutions, but usually with violence and the kind of consequences that both he and I abhor. The term I've begun using is something like what you're talking about, I think, Sandy. I use the term evolutionary reconstruction. We need to change the institutions, but we need to do it in an evolutionary way is the way I would look at it. So, for instance, we've been mapping this, as you know, we mentioned I've written a book called America Beyond Capitalism. A lot of it is simply mapping things that the press doesn't cover, like the development over time that there are 10,000 worker-owned companies in America. What's interesting about them is that they change who owns productive wealth to democratizing it in the sense that the workers own that. There are 130 million Americans, 40% of the society, are participants in some form of cooperative. A good share of them are credit union cooperatives, but the 30% is not credit. There are various worker-owned, agricultural, other co-ops. Again, different form, democratizing ownership. There are 2,000 public utilities. That's municipal ownership. Again, democratic ownership, not corporate. Many of them, by the way, in red states in the South, 25% of American electricity is provided by co-ops and public utilities, socialism, if you like. So if you look carefully on the ground, the Bank of North Dakota is a state-owned bank. Medicare is a national insurance program, essentially. That's what it is. Or so is Social Security. It's a nationalized pension program. You find elements of very interesting elements, and I could go on, but I won't, about the city and the neighborhood level, at all levels, that are suggestive of a different vision. And including in that vision, I want to make very clear the kinds of really creative business development that's going on, and I think Brian was referring to small and medium-sized business and interesting technology entrepreneurship. Much of that, I do want to put a footnote in. If you take a look at, I just written a piece about, not Steve Jobs, but but about our friends who's founded the, you know, the more interesting web pages these days, Facebook. Where would they be without the computer technology and the internet, paid for almost entirely in the computer development of it by the taxpayer? So, but nonetheless, very creative use of that resource. And there are a range of things that need to be developed, but many of them, I think, are developing. And if you look closely, a lot of them are developing out of pain levels. Worker co-ops in Ohio, for instance, there's some very creative things we could talk about, models that take you well beyond what we normally think about, worker-owned companies, in Ohio particularly, for reasons mainly doing because the system is failing, where cities are falling apart, the big corporations leave, and people are getting very creative. So I see the possibilities emerging that point towards a very different kind of vision, which would be both democratic, highly decentralized, and again, another dimension, most of this is green and developing in a very ecologically interesting way, that suggests a different vision that doesn't look like corporate capitalism, and it doesn't look like just free market capitalism, and it certainly doesn't look like state socialism, but it's very American, very down home.
In a sense, Gar Alperovitz, you're sort of talking about socialism, but not state socialism, more of a community-controlled socialism.
Well, you can use that term, but it's so loaded.
That's the thing, is that the term is kind of a dirty word, sort of like the word radical.
The interesting thing is
co-ops.
Go ahead, Brian Welsh.
In this realm, the only thing Gar and I disagree about is what to call it.
Mm-hmm.
I would call what he's describing as free market capitalism. He's talking about a free market reaction to a set of market conditions and to the public sentiment about institutions. And he's talking about a better form of corporate ownership. I don't see there's anything anti-capitalistic about it at all.
Well, I'm not sure he's talking about a better form of corporate ownership, but let's ask him about that. I mean, it seems to me that right now what we have is sort of a selective capitalism, where we sort of pick and choose the winners, and it's called capitalism, you know, when it works, and it's called socialism when it's not acceptable to the powers that be. But is that what you're saying, Gar Alperovitz? Are you saying that the corporate thing is fine, but it just needs to be sort of fine-tuned and made better?
Well, you know, I think I'm not sure how we let's move away from the rhetorical terms. I think they cloud the discussion.
All right.
Historically, most systems, the power base of most systems, how they really get controlled politically, and, you know, it's common sense, but it's also been documented in study after study, is who owns the capital? So in feudalism, it was the lords who owned the land, and they ran the show. And so I said 19th century capitalism in America was not perfect, to say the least, but it was a small scale, mostly farm businessmen. They weren't peasants. They were business farmers who were producing for the market.
But again, that was kind of dismantled by an economy that was becoming increasingly dominated by corporations.
Exactly, and that's the animal we now live with. And I think for a while it was balanced by labor, but that era is over. So now we're faced with a choice. If that one is in real trouble, and there's no balance wheel, and besides it was ecologically not very good because it was driven by growth in an era where we've got to relook that, what does it look like? And I think it requires who owns the capital still is a big deal. And if we start thinking about democratizing at the lowest level possible, small business, co-ops, neighborhood corporations, and then building up only when necessary to larger scale, to public when necessary, public corporation. We nationalized General Motors and Chrysler, and we de facto nationalized a good part of the big banks. Then some of those are going to go into crisis again, and at some point I would keep some of those in public control, particularly some of the big banks. So I don't think you can regulate them. If you could regulate them properly, that would be fine, but I think they're too powerful to regulate.
I mean, so, I think you're talking about, we certainly have our work cut out for us in a corporate-dominated economy trying to create that kind of system, Gar Alperovitz.
Well, that now that we're all on the same, I'm laughing. I say if we were all on the same page with the vision that I call it, you know, a community sustaining economy or a pluralist commonwealth, plural forms of democratic ownership. The question how you get from here to there, that's a question of whether or not the era we live in, and I usually say if you want to play this game, you're talking about throw 33 decades on the table. This is historic change, not just the next election. That means evolving steadily, piece by piece, getting the young folks back in, and they are coming in. They're very excited about some of these alternatives, mm-hmm. building mm-hmm. over time, step by step by step. That's the way it's done, if it's done at all. It's not, you're not going to knock down the walls of surrounding the major power tomorrow without a long, long process. My heroes, let me put it this way, and I'll stop talking. My heroes are the civil rights workers in Mississippi who faced death and torture in the 1930s and 40s because they laid the groundwork for what came later. And I think that's an analogy of what's beginning to happen with younger people at the grassroots level, building on these elements, the fruition of which could not occur without the, you know, decades of work. So in that sense, it's all good no matter how far we go. So I say this is the direction, and maybe we shall overcome, and maybe we'll just do good things.
And I hope so, Gar. But Brian Welch, I want to get back to the kind of growth imperative, the concept of endless growth. Richard Heinberg, actually a friend of mine, and lives here in Marin County, California, where I live, and he you probably both know he's the author of, among other books, The End of Growth. And so he's been on the show quite a few times talking about the limits to growth, and that if for no other reason, capitalism simply can't survive because in a world of limited resources, there are, of course, limits to growth. Brian Welch.
Well, I completely agree with that, and I think it's one of the more interesting puzzles we'll face in our lifetimes, is how do you create prosperity and distribute wealth in a world where the number of consumers is shrinking? We really have not hardly begun to think about it. It's an astonishingly complex puzzle.
And important, isn't it?
And extremely important, but one of the most important things that we'll tackle in the coming decades. You know, I think fundamental to this conversation is the question of who, in what direction do we transfer power? I don't really trust the power brokers in Washington to any greater degree than I trust the power brokers on Wall Street. And somehow maintaining the dynamism in both political and economic processes within our company seems to me to be the fundamental quasi-physical dynamic that we need to address. I think maintaining the access of consumers and of voters to the process and to the systems is fundamental. But I'm not interested in shifting power out of the executive suites and into the House of Representatives office buildings or the great houses of bureaucracy in Washington, because I think shifting power around by artificial means, by passing regulation, almost always causes a lot of collateral damage that's very hard to predict. Now, I'm certainly in favor of stripping out the laws which protect vested interests and opening up the economy and the democratic process to true market forces, true democratic processes. I'm much more inclined to favor proposals that reduce the level of protective regulation and increase the freedom and the flexibility of the system than I am in favor of simply, you know, moving chunks of power around between giant institutions, because I don't trust Washington to behave in more responsible or wiser ways than Wall Street or Silicon Valley behave.
And I mean, and in a sense, the system is set up so that anyone who has that kind of power is likely to misbehave. And so that's another big challenge that we face. But Gar Alperovitz, do you want to respond to Brian?
Well, I don't disagree with the thrust of what Richard said, but I think I disagree with where it ends up.
What Brian said?
What Brian said. I'm sorry. I wanted to mention Richard Heinberg,
yes.
And I are speaking at Harvard this weekend. So
good. Well, please do.
Yeah, we just picked that up from what you'd said earlier about Richard.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with the thrust of what Ryan said, but I do think I disagree. That is to say, the current structure of power in Washington is outrageously controlled and irresponsible. So to give more power there, I agree. And I don't think that can be done. I don't think you can get a democratic government that responds to the people unless you change the institutions of the society that have power.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so
why
we're back to that. It keeps circling back to that.
But who changes them, I guess?
The mechanism, I think, and this is what we could talk more about this, because we spend a lot of time on the ground working with these groups, is the people developing these new kinds of institutions from the bottom up, building from the bottom up in neighborhoods, in workplaces, in cities, in municipalities, in states, in counties, and I would say ultimately in regions. So without a change in the substructure, what we're going to get is what we both, none of us want. But ultimately, you're forced to ask, if there is a government, how do we make it democratic? You can't avoid government, and we must make it democratic.
And would those institutions include small businesses in your
opinion? Of course. Indeed. I have no problem with small business, and indeed, that's a major part of this.
In one hour, I think we've completely resolved all of our differences.
We're done. We don't ever need to talk about this again.
All set. I want to shake hands across the airwaves.
Yes, indeed, right, symbolically.
No, actually, I'm thinking that this is a conversation sort of like the one that right now I'm hosting between Joshua Frank and David Swanson when we're talking about the electoral system and whether or not Obama should be reelected, and if not, what we do outside the system, all of that. And it's ending up being a series of conversations, and the more I listen to both of you, the more I'm thinking we might want to go that direction with this conversation, because right now we only have just a few more minutes. So how do both of you feel about, we're not wrapping it up at this very second, but I just wanted to ask you before we do, how do both of you feel about kind of making this an ongoing conversation?
Well, I'd love to come back, and where are you located, Gar? Where's your?
I'm in Washington, and you?
Eastern Kansas, near Kansas City.
Okay, well, I'm a Midwesterner myself. I'm from Wisconsin originally.
Yeah,
so that's home country for me.
That really is the Midwest. I somewhat object to Ohio claiming Midwestern status.
I think you guys would make a dynamic duo, but I want to just bring up just briefly the Occupy movement.
Yep.
Gar Alperovitz. I mean, the Occupy movement is really driving home some of the things you're saying. I mean, the whole point of wealth concentration at the top, you know.
And
I mean,
also, I think they've you know, there would not have been such a response to the Occupy movement if people didn't feel in their hearts that something was, they articulated something a lot of people felt. But what I'm also seeing is, you know, a lot of the younger folks are really moving and responsive to the vision of co-ops and cooperative ownership of some kind, community development, community-based vision. And I think that's all to the good for them to, you know, begin really getting their hands dirty and building some of this stuff and developing. I do want to say something about these Cleveland model briefly, because it's the most sophisticated. A number of co-ops linked together in the city of big ones that are doing they're doing agricultural development and greenhouse development of a different kind. They're doing industrial scale green laundry, the greenest there, solar installation, and they're worker co-ops, but they're linked together like the ones in Spain and the Basque Country, with a revolving fund and building the community as part and parcel, not just for the workers, but for the community. Very sophisticated development. And it shows you what can be done, because in Ohio there have been many simple worker-owned companies, and they've built now to this more complex stage. And many cities, including Amarillo, Texas, is developing on this model. So there's a lot going on that the press just doesn't cover that gives you kind of an inkling of where we might go.
I think so, too. And Brian Welch, I wanted just to give you a chance to talk more within your comfort zone, shall we say. You said that you'd like to see a world where creativity is rewarded. I mean, I love that. And no one is excluded from financial success, regardless of, you know, whatever their situation. And that you'd like to see a world with clean air, clean water, you know, what we all want to see, a chance for everyone who wants to grow their own food. I mean, so we would all agree on that. But talk just briefly, and you only have about 60 seconds. Put it into a just kind of synopsize that vision and how we do that. And we'll do this again, so you don't have to feel like you have to get all your licks in.
My
principal goal is to convert the voices of people saying what we're saying here today, and we do largely agree, into joyful, enthusiastic, passionate voices in favor of better outcomes, better institutions, and a better world, and less inclined to set themselves up against a lot of existing institutions that admittedly are destructive. But we've talked far too much against and far too little in favor of something. And I applaud people like Gar and the folks in the Occupy movement who have a vision and who are out there sharing a more positive vision for future generations of human beings.
And now to Gar Alperovitz. And this is more in your realm. It seems to me that in a real democracy, our economic system would make it possible for you know, we the people, if you will, to make a living wage. I mean, otherwise, how do we create a meaningful democracy? I was going to say maintain a meaningful democracy, but I thought better of it. I mean, a lot of Americans right now can barely afford a roof over their heads or put food on the table. So they can hardly be expected to contribute to or advance democracy.
Talk about this. Yes, indeed. Here's how I think about it. We don't have an economic problem in the United States at all. We have a political problem in managing the richest economy in the history of the world. This economy today produces almost $200,000 for every family of four. It's about 192. If we weren't in recession, it would be 200,000. There is no economic problem in the fundamentals. So one of the question is how we both use that resource, how we distribute it differently, how we create and build on it. That is the heart of the problem. Most people aren't aware of that. And the maldistribution of income and wealth is part of it, but more important is the maldistribution of power that's gone along with the corporate and financial concentration. So, yes, this society has the possibility of creating an incredible society. And that's why these institutions and these new visions of community and cooperation and the new practical things that some of the very creative entrepreneurs are doing, that's what does count. I totally agree with the notion that that a positive vision is absolutely critical. I do think we're going to have to challenge some of the old, essentially corrupt institutions. But if we don't have a positive vision and clear understanding building from the ground up, we've got nothing. But this is a rich society that everyone could afford to live wonderful lives.
And this is a rich conversation. I mean, this is one that I think we definitely need to continue with. So I'd love to have both of you back. Thank you so much to both of you, Brian Welsh, Gar Alperovitz. I mean, what an extraordinary contribution to the narrative, for democracy in this country and indeed in the world. And I just thank you both so much for your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy.
You're very welcome. And so we're wrapping it up for tonight's political analysis. Again, our guests were Brian Welch, Gar Alperovitz, and we'll see you next week here on Political Analysis. I'm Sandy Leon Best. Thanks to our board op, Greg. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.